Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and it's Friday, so let's jump right into our week in review. This week, the number of Massachusetts politicians who won't be running for president increased by at least one.
We realize that, there's no way around the fact that the process is cruel. I think we realized that that was going to draw in and affect people we loved who were not necessarily prepared for that.
That, of course, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who dipped his toe in the presidential waters and then said no thanks. Then there's former Senator and former Secretary of State and former presidential candidate John Kerry, who said yesterday he's probably not running, not really, not now anyway.
Occasionally it crosses your mind to sort of think about, you know, would you, won't you? I think we got a lot of good people around, personally, and We'll see sort of where it goes, but I'm not doing anything to actively pursue that.
That leaves Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's actively considering a run, even preparing for one. So with just 424 days until the Iowa caucuses, who's running and who's not? And joining me now is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti website. Hi, Renee. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Hello and happy Friday to both of you.
It's good to be with you.
So let's talk about Deval Patrick, his decision to stay out. He talked about this being a cruel process. What's your reaction? I'll start with you, Renee.
Well, I guess, to be honest, I guess I feel a sense of relief because I think our state is still traumatized from the experience of Michael Dukakis and then John Kerry running for president. And absolutely, our politics have gotten undeniably more cruel and brutal since even those days. And, accelerated by social media and by, the internet generally and by the sort of lack of referees to try to keep our politics into some sort of order. So I completely understand it. I don't think anybody will criticize him for this decision. And, I kind of hope that he'll stay involved somehow. I mean, I've got some thoughts about how he might do that.
Oh, good. Well, let's talk about that in a minute. But Jim, let me come to you and get your quick reaction from what we learned this week from Deval Patrick.
Look, I think we are in a cruel cycle. We go through these cycles all the time. If you go back to Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams, they traded, accusations of, you were sleeping with Russian prostitutes when you were ambassador to, you killed your own militiamen, Andrew Jackson. How dare you do that? We've seen a lot of it. We'll talk about H.W. Bush perhaps later on. That was a pretty cruel campaign as well. And I think The Mondale Reagan one was as well. So I don't think this had much to do with cruelty, because I think that if Governor Patrick could have lined up David Axelrod and that crowd around him, which is possible, that is a team that perfected the Machiavellian art of inserting the stiletto into the sternum with a smile on your face. So I think he could have handled that. I think the decision's based on two things. One is that I think Governor Patrick looked at this and said there's going to be a sort of two dozen politician pylon that he's going to have to kind of wake his way through. And is he the person to do that? And I think the second thing is, I think he understood that he could not win in this climate. And what I mean by that is, look, if we are in a foul mood at full employment in a way that we've never seen before, can you only imagine when the downturn comes? And it's going to come. And it may actually coincide with the next cycle. A patrician-style positive message like John Kerry's or Hillary Clinton's, the Bushes, it does not work in this environment. You actually have to be something of a loudmouth, and that's not what he plays well at.
I actually think that precisely for that reason, it might have been a good year for him, or that 2020 might have been a good time for him, because our politics, in the last several decades has gone back and forth on the pendulum, swinging from one extreme to the other. And in a way, I think just what you're talking about, his idealistic kind of low-key positive message is a real clear corrective to Trumpism. And maybe that's what people are hungry for.
I sort of like that idea. And to that end, I want to play a piece of tape from him, because I want to talk a little bit about what he might have brought to the presidential race. I mean, he campaigned for a number of candidates leading up to the midterm elections. And so here he is last month speaking in Cleveland about America, about what ails it. And his sort of reverence for, you know, what he calls the sort of shrine of civic engagement. And he can, as you know, he can speak so eloquently about this stuff. And here's a little bit of what he was saying just last month.
When bullets fly in houses of worship or in schools or in nightclubs or in grocery stores, and our leaders choose the slogans of the gun lobby over the lives of innocents, remember that we cannot be great without being good. When unarmed black and brown citizens are shot down by unaccountable police, when our justice system is not yet consistently just, remember that we cannot be great without being good.
And he went on, he talked about, when we put people who are trying to get into our country in cages and separate families at the border, we cannot be great if we cannot be good. I mean, it just seems like he's the guy who can use words so well. I would love to have heard some of those ideas in the midst of this this coming presidential campaign. Whether or not he would have succeeded, I don't know. But what are we losing by not having him a part of it, Jim?
Look, I think it's the height of his rhetoric has always been his great power. I remember the first time that he came to speak at a Pioneer Institute event, our entire audience of 300 people stood up after he spoke and gave him a standing ovation. He was a new governor at the time. And these were people who were probably not immediately inclined to support him, I'd say, right? So, I mean, that's the kind of power that he has. And he's an amazing guy. I guess what I'd say is look at the midterms, the people who won. Look at the way in which certain people who were angling to become president are behaving. Look at back at how Trump mowed down an entire generation of Republican leaders as if it were a firing squad. True. And what I'd say is look at Cory Booker, another incredible speaker. Kamala Harris, also a very good speaker. And you look at the way in which they're actually positioning themselves. I think the big news story this week as it relates to this, and you think this is crazy, is France. Mm-hmm. That you have a president in France who's aiming for something higher, something more global in reach, something that aspires, if you will, to the better angels. And look at the response that he's gotten. I think, you know, in history, throughout history, whether it's the French Revolution, the American Revolution, it's down to the 60s and sort of the what I would consider to be sort of the crazy academic rebellion of the time, we go hand in hand with the French. And I think that we're in for some tough times to come.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think that's such a, you know, dark, bleak, maybe accurate, you know, but bleak view of our politics and of our future here. I mean, I think that... you know, yes, I remember when Deval Patrick was running against Carrie Healey on the Republican side, and she accused him of, you know, just words. Remember that? You know, she said, oh, everything you say is just words, just beautiful rhetoric. And he said, oh, yeah, just words. You know, ask not what you can do for your country is just words. And, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, whatever, are just words. And, he really does appeal to a higher... calling, I would say, in politics, as did George W. H.W. Bush and John Kerry and a whole other generation of folks who felt that running for public office was a kind of service. I don't know. I think that you're probably right that there is a international movement afoot, which is very dark. But we're never going to break that by, continuing to run campaigns with politicians who just play into that. We need to somehow, somewhere along the line, cut that cord.
So, Renee, you you made mentioned earlier in the segment about ideas about what Deval Patrick should do next. So we asked him whether this was the end of his political career once and for all. Here's what he said.
Well, who can predict? There are lots of ways to help, and I intend to be as helpful as I can in this cycle without being a candidate. Listen, I'm having a ball with our impact investing business. It's been incredibly powerful, and you know, if I can't in this cycle make change in government, I can make change in capitalism.
So Deval Patrick, of course, working for Bain, he's talking about the impact fund, which makes money while doing good. That's the idea anyway. But Renee, what were you thinking about when you thought about where does he go from here?
I was just thinking about the campaigning he did on behalf of so many of the congressional candidates in not traditionally Democratic districts, where he helped galvanize voters and make a difference in those campaigns. And I also think, you know, if a Democrat were to win the White House next, there's a cabinet position that, you know, could be appropriate for him. But, you know, you just have to divorce your Deval Patrick would have to divorce his idealism from his ego. You know, you don't necessarily have to be have the spotlight on you as a candidate for president in order to have your ideas, you know, enter into the conversation. And I just hope that those ideas he has about, you know, public service and why we, you know, we can't be great if we're not good, will get into the discourse in other ways.
So John Kerry is out. That leaves Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's been actively preparing for a run. She says she'll be deciding soon. Not everyone is on board with that, including the Boston Globe. It editorialized this week and urged her to reconsider a run for the White House, calling her a divisive figure with, quote, a ceiling on her popularity. Unquote, pointing out that Governor Baker, in fact, won more votes than she did in this last election. Jim, what's your what's your reaction to what's next for Elizabeth Warren?
So if I could, I'll get right to that. But I just want to comment on something related to Governor Patrick.
Sure,
if I could.
And
I think what's missing from what will be missed in terms of his non-participation in this is his connection between the good and who we are is extremely important. I think extremely important for the left. And what I mean to say is, and this is where I don't mean to be dark, but I'm a realist. We are in for another 10, 20, 30 years of great dislocations in terms of the employment base. This will affect the way that people behave and think about their politics. Mm. If we are completely disconnected in how we think about how we are as a nation, and that's nationalism to some degree, if we divorce that from the good and our conceptions of the good, we're in deep trouble, not just the United States, but everybody. And that's something that Governor Patrick is fully capable of articulating. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Elizabeth Warren is capable of that sort of thing, but I do believe the left needs that, because in this time of dislocation, you can see it in Europe, all over Europe. People are running for past identities and maybe new identities, and I think the Americans will also be up against that. Is Elizabeth Warren able to articulate that to some degree? I really don't know. But I do think that's the great intellectual challenge for the left if they're going to win from Trump. And that is to say, we have a different vision of what this nation is. And it has all these values from the past. And it also has a future that's positive. But at the same time, it needs to be protective to some degree, or feel some kind of protection for the people. Because people are going to be hurt for over the next few decades because of all the dislocations. Just being a realist.
Renee, we're coming up on a break, but let me just give you the last few seconds to sort of offer whatever you would. I asked about Elizabeth Warren, but how do you want to close it out?
Oh, well, you know, I think what Jim is saying is really profound, actually, and very true. And it's just a question of whether we redirect our rage as people who are hurting toward, you know, what I would consider to be the true causes of these economic dislocations, and not on each other, which I think is what the situation we're in now.
Wow. Well, some great, profound thoughts, for which I thank you both. We're going to come back. Stay with us, listeners. We have to take a break. When we return, we're going to continue our week in review with Renee Loth and Jim Sturgis. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's get right back to our week in review. With me are Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. And let's talk about the case of Judge Shelley Joseph in Newton District Court this week. She was hearing the case of Jose Medea Perez, arrested by Newton police on drug charges. He faced a fugitive warrant for drunken driving in Pennsylvania and a detainer from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And in fact, an ICE agent was in the courtroom, and Medea Perez faced the possibility of immediate deportation. So the case was to be continued. It's not exactly clear what Judge Joseph instructed, but after the hearing, Jose Medea Perez was escorted downstairs in the courtroom, released from custody, and allowed to leave through the back door and thus avoid the ICE agent. Governor Charlie Baker says Judge Joseph should be removed from the bench pending an investigation into all this. Here's the governor.
Judges are not supposed to be in the business of obstructing justice. And as far as I can tell, based on the facts as they were presented, she clearly violated the court's own policies.
Now, we spoke to former federal judge Nancy Gertner, who provides legal analysis to us, and she said Baker's position violates this important principle around the separation of powers. Here's Nancy Gertner.
Our governor, let me say this clearly, has no right to criticize to direct or to suggest that a judge should be taken off a particular case. He just doesn't.
Jim Sturgis, what's your take on what's going on in this complicated and sort of interesting case?
This one has a strange feel to it because I think, you know, everyone who knows who's followed Governor Baker knows that he's an extremely cautious person. So this one is kind of throwing caution to the wind to some degree. I mean, the fact is that once appointed, the governor has no control over judges besides putting forward a budget proposal that has impact on operational matters like, you know, are you going to buy an IT system? You know, what's your staffing? That's kind of the end of it. This is a separation of powers issue. Doesn't mean he can't talk to court officials, but whatever he says really has no holding here. There's going to be a federal investigation, and there will be a complaint, I believe, filed with the Commission of Judicial Conduct. That's the proper process. We get to the facts, and we make decisions. I personally get a little bit worried when I see at every level of government where people jump in and say, you're guilty without a process. I think, you know, people should just hold back and not feel like they have to give an opinion immediately as they do on Facebook.
Yeah, interesting. Renee, what strikes you about this case?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, first of all, let's stipulate that if the judge did turn off a recording device in violation of court rules, that's a bad thing and it's a bad idea. But to convene a federal grand jury to investigate her is a tremendous amount of overreach, I think, on the part of the federal government here. There is a process, as Jim said, for disciplining judges. It's to call in the Judicial Conduct Commission. But this is, it seems to me, a federal encroachment. We're talking about the executive branch of, in terms of Charlie Baker encroaching on the judicial branch. This is a federal encroachment on state courts. And I just think that it's a symptom of the federal government's probable, disappointment or anger. I don't even know what you would call it. You know, federal law enforcement is annoyed, let's put it that way, with the Massachusetts courts because of a Supreme Judicial Court decision last year that court officers cannot detain, hold people on immigration warrants alone, making ICE's job more difficult. And so it feels a little bit like payback to me. And I think it's just a bad precedent all around.
I mean, part of what's going on here, too, is that, at least according to immigrants' rights advocates, is that ICE is increasingly showing up at courthouses to make arrests. And to what extent is that a concern, Jim?
Well, you know, I think it's a question of, and I'm not an expert in the area of this area of law, so I don't know the extent to which an action by a judge to allow someone to leave the court, if that's what in fact happened, violates federal law. I just don't know. But if the feds actually feel that is the case, I would expect they would do this sort of thing where they'd place people into the courts. Is that a situation we'd like to have? No, it's not. But I just don't feel like I know enough about the federal legal aspect of it to give an opinion.
This defendant was free to go. Let's remember this, right? The fugitive warrant that was out for him turned out to be the wrong guy in Pennsylvania, so that was dropped. The drug charges were continued. You can't hold somebody just on a warrant, an immigration warrant alone. That's what the SJC said. So he was free to go. And you know, the judge let him out the back door instead of out the front door where he would have been arrested by ICE.
Right.
He was later picked up, you know, a couple of days later by immigration officials, and an immigration judge let him go. Okay, so he's still free pending his case. So, I mean, let's not blow this up into, you know, something that it's not. And you know, I think that we are in danger of just, sensationalizing this case.
So I want to leave time very quickly to just talk about the passing of President George H.W. Bush, the 41st president of the United States. Here's Bush's eldest son, George W. Bush, speaking at services at Washington National Cathedral. We might not have the tape ready. Oh, we do. Here we go.
Your decency, sincerity, and kind soul will stay with us forever. So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man.
So lots of remembrances this week. I'd love to just, by closing today, just ask you both for your thoughts on the passing of the nation's 41st president. Renee.
Well, you know, I covered the Bush inaugural in 1989 for the Boston Globe, so I knew him a little bit. Of course, you know, he had just finished dispatching Mike Dukakis, our own governor. But, you know, everything has to be seen in context of today. And in that context, in the context of today's brutal politics, Bush does look like the last of a breed. Mm-hmm. You know, a kind of genteel WASP New England, Yale-bred ethic he had there of national service. And I think you can't take that away from him. But I think the legacy is mixed. You have to also remember that he got us into the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, and that he gave us Clarence Thomas on the U.S. Supreme Court, which I don't think anybody would say was his finest appointment.
Hmm. Jim Sturgis, final thought from you.
He had one of the best, I mean, truly a remarkable resume. He was, I think, more Yankee patrician, to Renee's point, than Lone Star Yankee, as some people like to call him. He certainly was not an ideologue, and there's a lot that's good with that in terms of compromise. There's a lack of clarity, I think, he brought to policy that came with that as well. He was absolutely globally focused. And if you remember at the time, he had no true domestic agenda. And in fact, I have to admit, that is why I voted against him and voted for Bill Clinton in 1992. I just felt like there needed to be a change. I think his legacy is dependent on President Trump, whether his new world order remains. And there is the fact that his son did set us on a path of extreme war for many years.
Mm. Well, Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thanks so much for coming in and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And thanks as well to Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti blog. Renee, thanks so much.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, a podcast featuring conversations with ex-offenders who are out of prison and trying to restart their lives. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.